Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on how fares the tax protester movement when we come back. You know, if you're earning about $50,000 a year, and if you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. The government gets the other 60%. That's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25%, and the government will net 75%. Now, isn't that just even more special? It means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you'll net $4,000 more. That's 8% more net take-home pay than you got this year. You produce twice as much and net 8%. And that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information that answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we work so hard and receive so little. And let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School, now available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're on the line, that is the web, you can order it through the webpage georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org. Or call direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Tax protest. It's been around for a long time. People have been protesting and marching and waving pickets and banners and jumping up and down upon the ground, biting the bushes and getting real excited about taxes, especially the income tax. Well, back in 1986, the tax focus people, they put out a newsletter for CPAs and accountants, put out a little piece on how fares the tax protest movement 20 years ago. Well, we could ask the same question today. How fares the tax protest movement 20 years later? And in 1986, you know, that was 20 years after 1966, and the tax protest movement got off with a bang during the Vietnam War, you know, back in the mid-60s. And by 1985, it was a big, big problem for the IRS and for the government. But by 1985, the Supreme Court of the United States had decided, well, not just the Supreme Court, I shouldn't say the Supreme Court by themselves, but the Supreme Court and the Circuit Courts of Appeal, of which there are now 11. At that time, I think there was 9. They got together, and over a period of 20 years, from about 1965 to 85, in that neighborhood, they decided 100 cases. And in those 100 cases, they never struck down the income tax. They never said it was unconstitutional. They never got real excited about it and banned the IRS or did away with the taxing system. And from 1985 until 2005, they haven't done it either. And there are still tax protesters out there that are using the same tactics, making the same legal arguments that have been made over the past 40 years, and none of them ever worked. Now, how's that for a program? So I thought we'd take a look at the tax-focused people and take a look at the tax protester movement. Let me take you through and show you what the root cause of this failure is. And I'm going to make a prediction that if you want to argue and be a tax protester for the next 20 years, in the year 2025, you'll have the same record or the same results as you've had over the last 40 years, and that is zero. Zip. Now, I'm not opposed to the income tax. I think that the government needs an income tax. Of course, I don't pay the income tax, and I don't want to participate in it, and I don't have a Social Security number, and I don't want to participate in Social Security either. And these are voluntary programs, and people will use in their tax protest arguments that the income tax is voluntary, and that's absolutely correct. It's voluntary. And everybody has volunteered for it. You volunteered for it when you got your Social Security number. When you went down and got your taxpayer identification number, you volunteered. When you join the Army, you go down and sign a piece of paper. It's called an enlistment contract. And that's what makes you a soldier. Well, that and the oath. You gotta take an oath, you know. And people complain about the income tax. I'm not quite sure that they understand why they're complaining about it. They go down, sign an enlistment contract, and then complain about the terms and conditions of the contract. It's a little late at that point in time. You should read the contract beforehand, then make an educated decision, an intelligent and informed decision, and either sign up or don't. And the income tax and the national economy have a lot of perks and benefits that go along with it. For instance, as a taxpayer, you can buy a house on time and deduct all the interest that you're paying. I can't do that. And you can join up with this income tax system, and you can retire on Social Security and get a check every month for the rest of your life. A lifetime guaranteed annual income. I can't do that. I don't qualify for Social Security. I don't collect Social Security, and I can't get in on the program. And that's because years ago I made an intelligent and informed decision. I hope it was intelligent. I don't know if it, a lot of people look at me and they say I'm the dumbest critter that God ever put breath into, but, you know, I'm happy as a clam at high tide, and I'm not complaining about the income tax or Social Security. I'm not opposed to people that draw Social Security. I'm not opposed to people that pay income tax or participate in borrowing and lending schemes with banks and government institutions and to pay usury and interest and buy houses and homes and make millions of dollars and pay lots of capital gains and income taxes. If that's what they want to do, they certainly have a right to do that. It's a choice that you make, and a lot of people make a lot of money at it. I never could make any money working for wages. I tried it. I tested that theory. I worked as a truck driver, a plumber, a carpenter, and a mechanic, and, you know, I tried working at the International Harvester and the big corporations and one thing and another, and I made a living, and I made a good living. I wasn't complaining about it, but I didn't make any money at it. And so I woke up one day and I said, Jesus, is, you know, by the time I pay my taxes and Social Security, that takes a third of everything that I create and produce. Did you know that? Did you ever stop and think about that? Take a look at the 16% Social Security tax. And then take a look at the 17% income tax and put the two together. Do you ever add that up? 7 and 6 is 13. 1, 2, and carry the 1 is 3. 33%. Yes, sir. Bob, 33%. One third. And that's just two taxes. Remember I said here in the first opening ad, I said, hell, there's 14 of these taxes. 14 taxes you people are out there paying. I say you people out there, you know I'm one of them people. I pay tax too, just like everybody else. So some taxes I try to avoid, like AIDS, herpes, and VD, income, and Social Security are a couple of them. But you know, you buy a house and you gotta pay property tax, and you buy gasoline, you gotta pay gasoline tax, you know. And you buy an automobile and you gotta pay a luxury tax or an excise tax, and there's taxes, and they got labels and names and legal terms on here like direct tax and excise tax. And what do those terms and what do those words mean? You know, is there a meaning to that? Well, let's take a look. The federal taxation system depends on correct self-assessment by all taxpayers. And tax returns are not vehicles for expressing personal, religious, or other beliefs. The Internal Revenue Service is not the appropriate forum for expressing concern over government spending policies. Congress has found that unauthorized and unfounded tax protestations on returns significantly impugn the efficacy and integrity of the tax system and for deterrent purposes should be levied with substantial penalties. I might point out, did you know that one-third of adult Americans do not file or pay income taxes? One-third. So all the income taxes are being paid by the other two-thirds. And I'm sure that the two-thirds that are paying those taxes are not very happy about the one-third that aren't paying their fair share, as they would term it. The above statement is a judicial capsule comment on the tax protester movement that sprang up in the 1960s and is continuous and continuing to this day. As the movement grew, Congress reacted to this threat to the revenue system by incorporating penalties into the tax code to strike at those protesters who have adopted frivolous or meritless tax positions and also to discourage other individuals who might be tempted to employ similar tactics in order to escape the payment of income tax. Income tax. Has it ever occurred to anybody to stop having income? I know it's a wild concept over there, but I bet you if you didn't have any property, you wouldn't have to pay any property taxes. And if you didn't buy any gasoline, you wouldn't have to pay any gasoline taxes. So I just kind of figured that if I didn't have any income, maybe I wouldn't have to pay any income tax. Tuck it away in your heart and tag along. We'll talk more about it as we progress. Although many types of tax protester positions have been found to lack merit and penalties have been imposed, the IRS believes that the variations on the tax protest theme are far from exhausted, and the time and energy devoted by an increasing number of individuals to the tax protest crusade suggests that many new modifications will be forthcoming. Moreover, tax protesters continue to use arguments that have been struck down by the courts as frivolous or meritless and that threaten to clog the judicial system. In response, the courts not only impose penalties, damages, court costs, and reasonable attorney's fees against protesters, but they also sanction attorneys who repeatedly represent them. On the other hand, the courts also seek to ensure that the IRS does not infringe on taxpayers' constitutional rights. So who are these tax protesters anyway? Well, tax protesters come in many forms. Some engage in a coordinated effort to disrupt effective tax administration by encouraging others to violate the tax laws. Other protesters go so far as to advocate the use of violence against the IRS and other government employees. But the more common variety of tax protester is an individual who files returns that do not contain the required information from which taxes owing can be assessed or that contain false or incorrect information and who bases his action on a frivolous position or harbors the desire to delay or to impede the administration of the federal income tax laws. Likewise, the means employed by the tax protesters take many shapes. Some engage in noncompliance through tax schemes involving family trusts. Others set up a church or other purported religious entity and then assign their income to the organization, which in turn pays the donor's living expenses. Then, there are those protesters who refuse to comply with the return filing statutes, grounding their action on claims that their constitutional rights are being violated by this taxation system. So penalties are aimed at these protesters. And in 1982, Congress realized that special measures were needed to dampen the protester movement, and it enacted several statutory penalties designed specifically for this purpose. Among these penalty provisions is Code Section 6702. 6702 calls for the imposition of a $500 civil penalty for the filing of a frivolous return. This penalty can be imposed by any individual who, in furtherance of a frivolous position, or with the intention of delaying or impeding administration of the tax laws, files a purported return that lacks information from which the correctness of tax liability can be determined, or that clearly indicates that the tax liability shown is substantially incorrect. The Code Section 6702 penalty was intended to attack a variety of protest activities. It provides for a flat $500 penalty that is not geared to the amount of tax liability involved on the return. Liability for the penalty arises immediately upon the filing of a frivolous return, and there's no requirement that the taxpayer be given advance notice of the penalty's imposition. However, taxpayers who pay 15% of the assessed penalty and then file claims for refund can obtain district court review of the assessment. Tax protesters are also the target of Code Section 6673, which authorizes the tax court to assess damages against a taxpayer who institutes or maintains proceedings in that court primarily for the purpose of delay, or who takes a position that is clearly frivolous or groundless. Up to $5,000 in damages can be imposed by the tax court under this statutory provision. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit recently made it clear that the maximum penalty amount that the tax court may assess with respect to any case is $5,000. In the case in question, separate notices of deficiency were issued to a husband and wife, but the tax court issued only one order. The government attempted to defend the court's imposition of $5,000 in damages against each spouse, for a total of $10,000, but they failed to cite any case in support of their position that the tax court has authority to impose a double penalty, for example, $10,000 in damages. Well, up to $5,000 in damages may be assessed under Code Section 6673, where a taxpayer is found to have instituted or maintained his action merely for delay. Thus, a tax protester who might otherwise avoid penalty liability on the ground that he instituted his action out of ignorance may still be penalized if he continues with the action after he has been informed that his position is considered to be frivolous. In addition to the special civil penalties applicable solely to tax protesters, a tax protester may face the other civil and criminal penalties that apply to all taxpayers where negligence or fraud is found to be present in the protester's claim. Thus, for example, an IRS agent may refer a case for criminal prosecution under Code Section 7201 where the issue of tax evasion is involved, or under Code Section 7203, where there is an apparent willful failure to file a return, supply required information, or to pay the tax. Conviction for tax evasion is punishable by a fine of up to $100,000 and or imprisonment for up to 5 years. Conviction for willful failure to file, to pay, or to keep the required records or supply required information carries with it the risk of a fine of up to $25,000 and or imprisonment for up to 1 year. So, what about protecting the protesters? Well, although the courts have been inundated with frivolous tax protester actions, there is nevertheless judicial concern that these cases be properly decided. For example, in R. May, the Eighth Circuit found that the tax court failed to make specific findings of fact to justify its imposition of damages against an individual who argued that he did not volunteer to self-assess himself. The appellate court, on its own, reviewed the entire record and then concluded that the taxpayer's course of action evidenced that he filed his petition primarily to delay the payment of taxes. However, the appellate court cautioned the tax court that in the future it must provide the review courts with the relevant facts to decide whether the tax court had properly exercised its discretion in imposing Code Section 6673 damages against a taxpayer. Now, protection of a tax protester's rights was also the concern of a federal district court in Montana that held that the IRS improperly imposed the $500 frivolous return penalty against a woman and improperly attached her bank account and filed a lien on her property. The taxpayer in this case had filed a complete tax return but had typed the words "signed involuntarily" under penalty of statutory punishment above her signature. So the IRS agent admitted that the typed phrase did not affect the accuracy of the return or impede in any way its ability to process that return. However, the IRS contended that although it was not sure that the return was frivolous, it was justified in invoking the penalty and placing the burden on the taxpayer to prove it wrong. Noting that the government employs hundreds of attorneys who can review a return when an IRS agent is uncertain as to the frivolous status of a return, the court condemned the government's position and the government's action in imposing this penalty, in this instance, as a violation of the taxpayer's First Amendment right to freedom of speech. And it also found that the government's actions in attaching her bank account and placing a lien on her property without first holding a hearing violated her Fifth Amendment right to due process. And in a rather bizarre case, the Third Circuit rejected the tax court's imposition of a civil fraud penalty, 50% of the tax deficiency, against a steel industry worker who failed to file returns for several years. This worker, during the period in question, had sent numerous letters to the IRS, the Secretary of the Treasury, and other high-ranking federal officials and his employer, informing them of his refusal to pay his income taxes. These letters, according to the court, did not support a claim of fraud. Instead, they made it clear that the steel worker intended to call attention to his failure to pay taxes. It would be anomalous to suggest, the court stated, that the taxpayer's numerous attempts to notify the government are supportive, let alone suggestive, of an intent to defraud. But there are positions that are rejected as being clearly frivolous. The courts have judged a variety of tax protester positions to be frivolous. Thus, protesters who continue to adhere to these positions in refusing to pay their taxes place themselves at risk. Now, the following descriptions illustrate some of the tax protester positions that have been labeled as invalid by the courts, such as religious or moral protests. This type of protests focuses on the government's use of federal revenues for military expenditures, or for some other purpose that the tax protester alleges to be morally, philosophically, or religiously objectionable and violative of his First Amendment rights. An advocate of the anti-military expenditures position generally prefers a religious or moral ground for reducing his tax liability by an amount based on the percentage of the federal budget dedicated to military use. Now, the 4th, the 6th, and 7th appellate circuits have ruled that a taxpayer's claim of a war tax deduction on a federal income tax return is without any merit. In fact, this position was specifically identified in the legislative history of Code Section 6702 as being frivolous. Another moral or religious ground that has been advanced by tax protesters as an excuse for reducing their tax liability or for refusing to file returns is the objection to the use of the tax revenues to fund abortion facilities. In one case, a priest refused to pay taxes because he believed that any law requiring him to contribute to the funding of abortion was unconstitutional. Although the court accepted the sincerity of the priest's religious beliefs and his ultimate willingness to pay his taxes, it found, however, that the IRS had established by clear and convincing evidence that the priest was in fact liable for all of the civil penalties applicable to fraud for filing false income tax returns. And then there are church schemes. While religious or moral principles are frequently advanced as grounds for protesting against abortion or military expenditures, other individuals attempt to use a purported religious entity as a means of escaping income tax. This type of scheme involves the establishment of a paper church, assignment of the taxpayer's income to that entity, and then the use of the church funds to pay the taxpayer's personal expenses. One particular church scheme that has been involved in numerous court decisions concerns the Universal Life Church. Many charitable contributions to a chartered congregation of this organization claimed by taxpayers have been disallowed as a result of their failure to prove that the local congregations were organized and operated exclusively for religious purposes, or that they had relinquished control over the allegedly contributed funds. For example, a letter carrier testified that he was an ordained minister of the Universal Life Church, and that he conducted the church at his personal residence, and that the church paid his rent, utility expenses, and other personal expenditures as compensation for his services to the church. And since the letter carrier had already been denied deductions for alleged charitable contributions to the church in an earlier case, the tax court found that his present return was frivolous and assessed $750 in damages. And then there are constitutional arguments, such as wages are not income. Many protesters claim that their wages do not constitute income. Rather, the wages are merely compensation received for labor. For example, they are an equal exchange, value for value. But the court's response to this claim is that Congress intended to tax income from whatever source derived, and they uphold the imposition of sanctions against adherents of this position. Fifth Amendment self-incrimination is another tax protest argument. The Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is frequently offered as a reason for a protester's refusal to file a return or to give complete information on that return. This type of protester usually argues that he is entitled to secure a ruling as to the possibility of incrimination in regard to each item on the return. This particular argument was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in a non-protester case almost 60 years ago, when it held that there is no constitutional right to refuse to file an income tax return because of the Fifth Amendment. While that decision also held that the Fifth Amendment generally does not authorize one to refuse to state the amount of income on a return, some more recent cases indicate that taxpayers may be entitled to claim the Fifth Amendment privilege with respect to specific disclosures regarding certain illegal income. Fifth Amendment due process. Some protesters assert that various Internal Revenue Code provisions violate the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. For example, the graduated income tax rates have been cited as discriminating between classes. So too have certain deductions or benefits that are available to some taxpayers but not to others. These arguments have been settled by the courts in favor of the government. The imposition of the Code Section 6702 penalty has also been attacked as violative of the Fifth Amendment insofar as a hearing is not required prior to imposition of the penalty. And this argument has been rejected by the courts on the ground that a taxpayer's rights are adequately protected by the procedures set forth in Code Section 6703, which permits a taxpayer to file a claim for refund after he's paid 15% of the penalty amount. The 13th Amendment, record keeping and withholding. Some protesters contend that the bookkeeping records, the maintenance and employer withholding requirements, result in involuntary servitude, and therefore they are unconstitutional. This argument has also been rejected by the courts as being frivolous. Well, hang on, boys and girls. We'll take a look at the 16th Amendment, the Federal Reserve System and Family Trust, and a few others of these frivolous type tactics, and then we'll continue on with this thing called the income tax. Tax focus, how fares the tax protester movement as of 2005. But you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like one, simply call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the tax protest movement. This thing of the income tax got started back in the mid-60s, and by 1985, it kind of reached its apex, and the Supreme Court had made more than 100, that is, the Supreme Court and the Circuit Courts of Appeal, the federal system, had made more than 100 decisions on the income tax. Now, if you stop and think about it, each one of those courts were making 100 decisions per year for 20 years. Now, that's 2,000 cases. 2,000 cases over 20 years. I mean, that's a lot of cases. And they have heard just about every tax protest argument that you can imagine. In fact, I couldn't even imagine 2,000 arguments. But they're all categorized. They're all listed. You can research them out. And they've got real people's names on them, and those are real trials and real appeals. that have gone through the adjudicatory process over this thing of the income tax. And except for three, 1,997 of them all lost. There are three valid defenses in an income tax case. Three. Isn't that just special? Okay. Here's what they are. If you want to argue income tax, it has to fall within three recognized avenues of defense. One is called reliance. That is, I relied in good faith upon my attorney or tax preparer. And that's Murdoch versus U.S., I believe it is, 1932. And then there's subjective good faith, the Atkins defense. Subjective good faith, about 1979. I read it in a book. It was copyrighted, and I didn't believe that the information that I was reading in a copyrighted book would be false information. Key here is that it's got to be copyrighted. And then the third is called religious free exercise. There is a defense under the First Amendment's religious free exercise, which is pretty narrow, but it's expounded on in Seeger versus U.S., in the Seeger Doctrine. Five winning and five losing arguments that you can make in an income tax case. Now, there's three avenues that you have. Two of those avenues, reliance and subjective good faith, will work one time. One time. And then after you've used them, then that's no longer reliance, is it? That's no longer subjective good faith. You know, once you find out that it's wrong, you can't come back and use a wrong argument a second time. So that leaves only religious free exercise then as a continuing methodology by which you can opt out of income tax and Social Security. And that's exactly what the Congress intended. And Social Security is a voluntary program, and your Social Security number is your taxpayer identification number. So if you have a Social Security number, you are a taxpayer. And you ought to pay your taxes, and you ought to sit down, shut up, and fold your hands. There's a second grade of taxpayers. You may not have a Social Security number, but because you wanted to participate in trade, commerce, business, and industry that affects a public interest under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8 of our federal Constitution, you got a taxpayer's identification number so that you could buy and sell stocks and bonds and mortgages and deal in Federal Reserve notes, commercial paper, and other evidences of debt which are specifically prohibited by God in Leviticus 19:35 and 36. And Deuteronomy 25:13-16. So if you've got a taxpayer identification number or a Social Security number, then you're a taxpayer. Now that just about covers everybody, doesn't it? And if you're a taxpayer, then if you have income, which is a crime of and by itself, income is the opposite to increase. And on income, you pay an income tax, and on increase, you pay a tithe. So if you would deal in property instead of income, deal in property instead of profit, and have increase instead of income, I think you'd have a different outcome in this thing called tax protest. I noticed that years ago. And I don't have any complaints about the IRS or income tax and Social Security. Those people that want to participate in it sign up, and I presume that they want to benefit from those perks and privileges. For instance, you got a Social Security number, you complain about the Social Security tax. But pray tell, how is the Social Security Administration going to pay you those benefits that you're looking forward to when you retire at age 62 or 65 if you don't contribute and don't pay in your fair share? I mean, you know, it's just common sense says that if you're going to participate, you got to pay. Now, the 16th Amendment there's an argument out there called failure to ratify. Now, the constitutionality of the tax laws has been attacked by some protesters on the grounds that the state of Ohio was not properly a state at the time of the ratification of the 16th Amendment. The courts reject this contention on the basis that the amendment was ratified by enough states, without counting Ohio, to complete the necessary three-fourths ratification requirement. Now, Federal Reserve System, that's another argument preferred by taxpayers, is that the Federal Reserve System is unconstitutional, with the result that the Internal Revenue Code is also unconstitutional to the extent that it taxes income or checks that do not contain or are not redeemable in gold or silver. The tax court and other courts have consistently labeled this argument as meritless. Meritless. Then there are family trusts. Another means adopted to avoid taxation is the use of a family trust. And although this type of tactic is not peculiar to tax protesters, it falls within the tax protester type of scheme to escape taxes. Generally, the taxpayer transfers the exclusive use of his lifetime services, including all remuneration therefrom, to a trust, which in turn pays the taxpayers and or his family's expenses. Normally, the courts treat these family trusts as sham transactions that are devoid of economic reality or as grantor trusts for the benefit of the taxpayer settler. Then there's the risk spillover to attorneys. Some courts have extended their sights beyond the tax protesters themselves to focus on the attorneys who represent these tax protesters. In one case, the court charged an attorney with knowledge that the appeal of his client's claim, which repeated standard tax protester constitutional challenges to the tax system, was frivolous and held him liable for double the court costs and $1,000 in government attorney's fees. So the attorney in question had represented other protesters in earlier cases involving the same challenges. This same attorney was again assessed double court costs and $1,000 in government attorney's fees in a later protester case. In a similar case, another attorney was assessed excess costs, expenses, and government attorney's fees. And another attorney was barred from practice before the tax court for 6 months for advancing the frivolous argument that wages do not constitute income for tax purposes. The suspension was upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which noted that the tax court Rule 33 requires counsel to certify that pleadings are not frivolous. The court rejected the attorney's contention that the tax court's order infringed on his right to zealously represent his clients within the confines of the rules of professional responsibility. Now, what does the future hold? Well, it's difficult at the present time to assess how well the government is faring against the tax protester movement. Many of the cases now coming before the courts have been in the judicial pipeline for some time, and it is too early to tell whether the statutory penalties and the court sanctions have yet made a serious dent in the movement. However, figures indicate that some progress has been realized. The IRS had 21,389 protest returns under examination and had closed 18,382 returns as of September 30, 1985, compared with 28,324 under examination and 23,571 closed in the previous year. Now, also, some 6,600 frivolous return penalties were assessed in 1985, as compared with 8,200 frivolous return penalties in 1984. This drop in return examination and penalty assessments may indicate that the imposition of statutory penalties, court costs, and attorney's fees is forcing more and more protesters to reconsider the potential cost of filing these protest returns. And also, more attorneys may be rejecting protest actions because of the court's recent actions in imposing penalties and suspensions on those attorneys who defend these protest or tax issues that have already been branded as being frivolous. I might point out that Roscoe Evers, he was the IRS tax commissioner back in 1985. And he was speaking before a group of accountants and lawyers and tax professionals down in Las Vegas, Nevada back in 1985. And he made a pretty astounding statement. I remember it was very newsworthy at the time. He said that as of the date that he was speaking, July 9th, 1985, that one third, approximately 32 million Americans had not filed their tax returns as of that date. 32 million people hadn't filed their tax returns by July 9th, 1985. Now that constituted about one third of the taxpayers in the country. I just saw a similar statistic here the other day. I forgot exactly where I saw it. I think it was in the International Forecaster, Bob Chapman, that as of 2005, one-third of American taxpayers, one-third of American adults is the way they worded it. Are not filing their tax returns. Now that's not a third of those that are retired. That's a third of those that are eligible and ought to be and are earning income and aren't filing tax returns. So nothing has changed in the tax protest movement as far as I can tell over the last 20 years. There's just as many of them out there. But instead of arguing with the government, you've got a third of the people out there that just aren't participating. Just aren't participating. And then there's a lot of other people out there that just fudge a lot. And our government's running some pretty big deficits. It's been estimated that if that one third of the people who are not filing and paying their taxes, if they would file and pay their taxes, there would be no federal budget deficit. But you've only got two thirds of the people in the country paying the taxes. And remember, the corporations don't pay tax. I want to repeat that. A lot of times, you know, people will write me letters and say, Gordon, you know, you've stepped off the deep end. Well, you've just jumped over the cliff. I said that corporations don't pay taxes. Never have, aren't designed to, don't now, and aren't going to in the future. Consumers pay income tax. Workers pay income tax. Corporations don't. So let me explain that so that you can understand how this game is being played. I used to be in the corporate business world, and I operated a corporation, and every year I filed a tax return, a corporate tax return. And I wrote a check every year. In fact, I wrote several checks. You have to write one every quarter to the IRS. And so right away somebody's saying, well, there, see, Gordon, you filed and paid taxes. But the Atlantis Manufacturing Company never paid a nickel's worth of tax, not a dime. In fact, all those payroll taxes, you know, that I wrote the checks out for, well, I didn't pay those. The employees paid them. You see, a corporation is an agent of the government. Now, we're just there to collect the money from you and to pay it over to the government. Middleman, kind of a middleman kind of guy. And then somebody says, well, yeah, but, you know, the corporations, they pay income tax, you know, like everybody else. Oh, no, they don't. No. In fact, a McDonald's Big Mac has 257 taxes on them, and McDonald's doesn't pay any of them tax. Not a nickel. In fact, in 1930, a hamburger sold for a nickel. Did you know that? Hamburgers still sell them for a nickel. And that other $1.37 on that hamburger, boys and girls, is tax. That's all that is. And so the corporation simply collects the money from you, pays it over to the government. You're sitting there saying, well, they're paying tax. A taxpayer is somebody that creates real wealth and then pays a portion of that over to the government. Corporations produce a lot of real wealth. They don't pay a dime's worth of tax. The consumer pays it all. So let me illustrate a point to you. You're working for a Chevrolet dealer, and they're paying you $10 an hour. Now, they charge $25 an hour shop rate, you know. We'll just pick a number. I know they don't work for $25 an hour anymore, but let's just take a number. And so you're getting paid $10. All right. So now you're saying to yourself, well, out of my $10, I got to pay Social Security tax. But my employer pays half of that. No. No, you got that mixed up. Your employer doesn't pay a nickel's worth of your Social Security tax, sucker. Not a nickel. Remember, he's charging $25 an hour. You're getting paid $10. So your employer, he takes $10. He takes $10 an hour. That's his profit. He puts that in his pocket. He gives you $10 less the taxes that he's deducted from you. Income tax, Social Security tax. And that other $5 that he charges in that shop rate is what he pays the Social Security tax. That's the other half of your tax. And the unemployment tax and the Medicare tax and all these other taxes over here. So in the final analysis, your boss doesn't pay a nickel's worth of tax. The consumer, the customer, pays it all. That is, you and the consumer pay all of the taxes. You, the real producer, the real worker. And you, the consumer, who brings your car into Mr. Goodrich to have it fixed. And the dealer doesn't pay any tax at all. Zero, zilp. And neither does General Motors. Or Ford. Or Chrysler. Or anybody else. Now, to make it look good, you know, for all of those Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives out there. I mean, see, you've got to make this look good. Let's take a government worker. A government worker doesn't pay any tax at all. None. Zero, zilch. Think about it. Where does the money come from? Government produces nothing, consumes much, and wastes the rest. So the government worker is making $50,000 a year pushing a pencil in some government office, creating statistics and numbers. That's your tax dollars at work. At the end of the year, he has to pay $10,000 in income and Social Security taxes. So he doesn't get $50,000, he only gets $40,000. None of the money, none of the $50,000 came from any productivity from a government worker. Government workers produce nothing. Nothing. Soldiers produce nothing. The people who produce the real goods and services are the farmers that produce cattle, meat, milk, butter, eggs, houses, automobiles, the things that you consume. Government workers don't produce any of those. They consume them. And in order for the government workers to consume those automobiles, meat, milk, butter, and eggs, and everything else, somebody had to create and produce them. Farmers pay taxes. Mechanics pay taxes. Construction workers pay taxes. Producers pay taxes. Consumers, that is, government workers, they don't pay any tax. Neither do corporations. So the burden that is placed upon the producers over here has gotten to the point where 51% of Americans, just everybody out there, just Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, government workers and defense contractors and corporations and individuals and partnerships and so on, to take all the people in America and all the business, all the GDP, they call it, the gross domestic product, $11 trillion worth, all the buying, selling, and trading that goes on out there. You add all that up. And 51%, just a shade over one half now, but 51% of all of those people out there are receiving a government check. You're a Social Security recipient. You're working for the government as a highway patrolman, or you're a government accountant, or a stenographer, or you're working at the driver's license agency or department. No, I'm not suggesting that those positions aren't necessary. I guess we got to have driver's license. I guess we got to have car registration. I guess we have to have highway patrolmen. But that isn't because they produce anything. They don't produce any meat, milk, butter, and eggs. It's kind of like having a guard bee in a beehive. I guess we have to have guard bees in a beehive, but they don't produce anything. They're a liability. They're like a drone. You know, drones don't produce anything, but I guess they're kind of necessary. They got to have somebody to breed the queen. But bees are pretty wise little critters, and when they get through with the drones, they kill them. They just consume honey and produce nothing in return. And, you know, the guard bees, they got to have some, but they don't produce an overabundance of them. They just produce as many guard bees as they need. They just produce as many water-carrying bees as they need and as many fan bees as they need, and the rest of them are workers producing honey, getting busy out there and actually producing something. Now, 51% of Americans are drawing a check. One-third of Americans aren't filing or paying taxes. Two-thirds of Americans that are filing and paying taxes are carrying the whole load, but they're unable to carry all of it. And so there's a big debt that is accumulating, $8 trillion at last count. And the one-third are looking around saying, well, look, I'm a producer over here, and I'm getting tired of producing, and I'm not getting my fair share out of this program. And so you've got the tax protesters. They're complaining because they're not getting their fair share. Then you got the taxpayers that are paying, and they're complaining because they're paying their fair share, but the rest of the people aren't paying their fair share. And so meanwhile, as the story goes on over here, you have a lot of discontent. I've never talked to anybody that's happy about the income tax program. I'm one of the few that isn't unhappy about the tax program. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just reporting it to you. Reporting here from the tax focus people here. As of April 30th, 1986, how fares the tax protester movement? Well, the tax protesters haven't gotten anywhere. Their goal, I guess, was to reform the tax system. There's nothing been reformed that I can see. George Bush came along and he said that he was going to give you some tax relief. And they passed a lot of tax reduction relief over here. But then they triggered a thing over here called a minimum tax. The income tax minimum tax. And once you fall into that minimum tax, it's greater than the income tax itself. So you got a tax reduction on the left hand, which was passed on to the right hand in the form of a tax increase. In fact, George Bush hasn't affected any tax relief, hasn't affected any tax reductions. Taxes are higher than they've ever been. They've shifted the tax burden from some people and put it on some other people over here, and that makes everybody, I guess, feel pretty good. But I'm one of those few people over here that says, well, I'm not paying the tax, and so I'm not complaining about it. I'm not receiving the benefits from the tax, and so I don't see any reason for me to participate in the program. And as we progress along here this week, I'll explain to you how that game is played. But keep in mind now, between now and tomorrow, have you ever thought about stop having income? Think about it. Stop having income. Wild new idea. Well, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.